So as a geotechnical contractor, you can control your scope 1 emissions, you can control your scope 2 emissions, but you can still influence your scope 3 emissions. Mm. At ARIP, we talk about not just our carbon footprint, but in a nice jargony way, talk about our carbon handprint as well, which is the carbon associated with the projects that we're involved in. So the emissions from material use, the emissions from running and maintaining stuff, and the emissions associated with people using whatever the thing is that is being designed or built.
Stay tuned to find out how geotechnical businesses can take action to reduce carbon emissions.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Thank you for joining us on the Breaking Ground podcast. Today, we're going to be discussing environmental sustainability and specifically carbon reduction. Coming back to the podcast is Alice Berry from ARIP. Alice is a geotechnical and sustainability engineer, and you might remember her from episode 19 when she was speaking with Demetrios Solimantis and Graham Webb, talking about the autumn conference season. We've also got Luke Diemer, who is the newly installed, congratulations, Group Sustainability Manager at Keller. Many of you will be familiar with Luke from his work with the FPS over the last few years, and is a great orator on this topic, so look forward to hearing from him. Also joining us is Erica, who Luke knows well from his doctorate at the University of Surrey. Erica is a visiting research fellow and also runs the carbon consultancy Russell and Dawson. I think probably a good place to start is just establishing where we are currently on carbon. It seems like every year we're kind of getting new figures and trying to understand exactly how much time we've got to deal with this emergency. Seems like a moving target at times. The increase in the temperature, largely caused by the burning of fossil fuels and other products, it's raised temperatures in the world by, I believe, 1.1% post-industrial levels. The consensus seems to be that if it goes above 1.5 degrees, then a lot of the world's population, potentially half the world's population, could be in an emergency situation. Luke, perhaps I can come to you first. Sorry to put you on the spot, but how soon, what do the graphs look like? Based on the current trajectory, are we going to get to 1.5? And why is it so important, that number?
Absolutely. So looking into my crystal ball and trying to predict what the climate looks like is always a challenge. One resource we do have in this space, though, is the IPCC reports, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And what they do is they set out a number of different RCP scenarios. So under different emissions from different countries, different particulate levels, what our climate might look like. And you're quite right to say that it's quite a scary topic, particularly if you look at some of the kind of business as usual type models of continued emissions. We're on track potentially there for over 2 degrees C of warming. And whilst this might seem like a small amount by itself, you know, 2 degrees in the UK might seem like quite a nice summer day compared to what we have today. Actually, it makes a real big difference in terms of a number of physical climate change effects, both in terms of those acute risks, so those short-term weather events, the risks of storms, for example, wildfires, hurricanes, things like this, but also the very chronic long-term effects of climate change as well. So for us in the geotech sector, that might mean things like desertification, that might be sea level rises and how that affects people. So it very much depends on how quickly we are to transition to this low carbon economy, what kind of effects we start to feel. And there are certain risks and opportunities to business along that way. But it's something that we've really got to get started on. And of course, a ton of carbon saved today is always better than a ton of carbon saved tomorrow.
Sure. And Alice, why is it so important that people in the construction industry take action on this? You know, there's lots of different industries in the world, but why construction?
Well, I think it's important that everyone takes action because it's a massive challenge. And if it were easy to fix by just 10% of something changing somewhere, we probably would have fixed it already. So everyone and every sector needs to take action. And when the UK made their net zero commitments back in, I think, 2019, one of the big changes was that, you know, getting to net zero, not an 80% reduction on previous levels, which meant that then the focus changed from bickering over who got to keep the last 20% to everyone having to do their bit. But it is also a fact that the construction industry is responsible for a large proportion of the emissions. The construction industry can be a great catalyst for sustainable development, and we shouldn't forget that. But a sort of traditional construction has been very beneficial for economic progress, for social progress, and a bit dire on the environment. And we need to change that balance and also understand that what we do to the environment affects what we do to ourselves economically and socially as well. Anyway, so these things can't be viewed in isolation.
Yeah, it's something like 40%, is that right, of carbon emissions could be attributed to the construction industry. Now, it's not all from the foundation sector, which obviously myself, Luke and Alice have focused on. Erica, you, I suppose, will look more broadly at this topic. And you've been involved in various different documents. Can you give us a taste of how the whole of the building chain, if you like, is looking at this and how much action there is maybe in the different parts of the industry currently?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about the whole of the building sector, I think we talk about buildings that are already there as well as buildings that are being created. And obviously a huge amount of emissions are sitting in buildings that are already there. And that, a lot of that is within their operation. So it's how they're being used, how people are using them. So this is why there is such an enormous focus now, not just on how buildings are built, so in looking in terms of their embodied carbon, the materials that are used, but also how they are built in a way in which can reduce those emissions in the future. It still doesn't help us with all the retrofitting that has to go ahead, which is probably our biggest challenge in this sector. What we are seeing is 10 or 15 years ago, this was a topic, this was an area of interest, but I think there has been a massive shift in the construction sector in actually beginning to really get to grips with some of these issues. And we're seeing leading players in all parts of the construction sector really trying to look at it, whether that's trying to look at perhaps more offside, much greater use of EPDs, even just understanding what environmental product declarations are. So I think there is a great shift. But coming back to some of the earlier comments that Luke and Alice were making, and perhaps in your questions, are we moving fast enough? And the absolute answer is no. Nice. And whilst 1.5 degrees warming is a target, it's something that we are really, really struggling to get to. And if we just wait and hope that in the next 20 or 30 years things will get better, we'll get better at doing this, it's too late. And that's the kind of really critical issue I think we're facing at the moment, is that speed of change.
So within the sort of conception stage of construction projects, and people might be familiar with the REBA stages, within stage one, is there now a requirement, whether that's driven by local councils or the government, to make reference to carbon reductions? Because to be honest, I'm not seeing, even on the latest projects, a reflection of action on carbon too often. Maybe it is further down, you know, we're only involved in quite early stages of projects, but I don't see that change currently.
I've seen it in some of the most progressive of the design agencies and the engineering firms. I think you probably see it on very high profile buildings, or more likely to. we obviously have a huge chain of building and builders that go down to very small developments as well. There, I would absolutely not see it. In terms of REBA, stage one, stage two, which is a critical bit to actually fix these issues in place, sustainability strategy is required, but not necessarily a huge focus on carbon.
Okay.
Can I come in there? Because to invite Luke to talk actually about some of the drivers for why doing a better job for sustainability and looking at whole life carbon reduction makes good business sense anyway, irrespective of whether the client demand has found its way through to the project yet. I think a lot of large clients, particularly the government arm's length bodies, will have to do more in this area, but it's perhaps not there in the projects that are on the go at the moment. I think in things like commercial developments, you know, there's much more demand for net zero buildings, whatever that might mean for new versus retrofit and so on. So I think it is coming, but even before it does, there's still good business reasons why you should be doing more of this. So maybe you want to say some more, Luke?
By all means, yes. What I'd just say quickly, actually, in terms of you started to hint at it there, Steve, you're right. Many of these things get lost in translation as they go from the client's first priorities on carbon. When they go through, as part of my research, my PhD research, I interviewed a number of beginning clients and asked them what they thought about in terms of sustainability for their construction, be that building or infrastructure. And many times carbon was mentioned quite overtly, climate change, resilience, these types of environmental sustainability type criteria. By the time it got down to geotechnical contractors, though, many of these things have been lost, either lost in translation with the pre-qualification questionnaires and supplier approval questionnaires not being passed on, being designed out by perceived efficiency or at least short-term cost saving. So sustainability for geotechnical contractors was seen as far more socially focused, about the well-being of people and communities and employee driven. And then by the time we looked at what we'd passed down onto our cement and steel suppliers, they were very much just talking about business, cost, quality, these types of things. And we'd lost many of those sustainability criteria. So a big push is actually translating these drivers that often are there down on the supply network. But to Alice's point, she's absolutely right. This has to be bigger than a project by project level. The idea that we can just drop sustainability the first thing, the first time a client doesn't request it, kind of misses the point in all of this. So of course, client demand is really important. We make a piece of trying to, you know, really emphasize this in some of our European Federation work and FPS work to highlight where there is this client demand and where particularly government procurement requirements right now for projects over 10 million do indeed require net zero plans for scope one, those direct emissions from fuel use, and scope two, indirect emissions from electricity use, and scope three, all other indirect emissions covering business travel, waste disposal, and material transport.
Yeah.
However, that is just the one driver. I was going to say legislative pressures, we spend a lot of time on that. Actually, I think it's more interesting to skip to the co-efficiency savings. You know, if we're saving cement, if we're saving steel, it is a cost saving, it's a time saving, it is everything else. This is kind of our design optimization piece that has many other savings as well. I think increasingly we're fighting over the same, we're fighting to get people into the geotechnical sector. We're seen as particularly wider construction as quite a dirty industry. And in terms of attracting, retaining talent, this sustainability angle is increasingly important. In terms of our own access to finance, increasingly it's ESG or environmental social governance or sustainability linked, particularly in the EU with some of the legislation coming down the track on that. So there's a number of different drivers that we have to work towards as a company as a whole, as well as looking at that project by project basis.
Just on the government schemes, you mentioned about the projects over, I think you said 10 million had to have clear items to reduce carbon. I can't understand why every single construction project shouldn't have solar panels, shouldn't have geothermal boreholes, shouldn't have air source heat. Why isn't that mandated? The government's making these big commitments on a world stage. I don't think the cost of these items, when you weigh up against the cost of a building, is going to prohibit that they're being built. You know, why isn't the government mandating that? if anybody's got an answer to that.
Yeah, I've got an answer to two points there. So the first one, why is it not mandated? I think the examples you came up with, it perhaps is wrong to mandate those specific things because every project or work package is different, and you want to come up with the best holistic solution, not be too prescriptive, okay. Which is not to say that those things shouldn't be turning up a lot all over the place. And the second one is you're talking about it shouldn't cost too much. You earlier were talking about rebirth stages one and two. And Luke was talking about these co-benefits. So I'd just like to remind everyone that putting sustainability principles and whole life carbon reduction early on in a project normally saves money and normally helps with the program and normally comes out with a better outcome overall. So if you can get these things in right at the start, you end up with a design that uses much less materials, with a project that gets right outcomes without having a kind of white elephant at the end. And those things, because they're in there right from the start of the project, they're also baked in. You can't value engineer them out later on when the cost gets a little bit tight. I'm not saying that solar panels are a bad thing, but if you're adding solar panels on top of a building to reduce to get closer to a net zero operational energy, it is more easy for someone to say, oh, but they're quite expensive, and I'll take them off. And often these things which have potentially a smaller carbon reduction impact, so swapping to a different type of material, they are the ones that can actually cost money. So keep your eye on the big picture. Having said that, I appreciate depending where you are in the value chain, you have more or less opportunity to influence the big picture. But we shouldn't forget that even if we can't directly control things, we can still influence them to a certain extent. And I think we should just give ourselves more of a license to query whoever our direct client is, to query the constraints that we're given and see which of those are real constraints and which of those are correct, and that our client has understood the sustainability implications of the constraints, which they may have set in some, you know, in a more business as usual kind of way.
I think this is why thinking about things in a whole life way is also extremely important, because I think here it allows you to really focus on the areas that are going to have a bigger impact as well. And I've seen construction jobs where people get very fixated on something that takes up a huge amount of man hours and time, but actually really isn't giving you the impact that other changes could do. So I think having that whole life view is really important. And I thought it was interesting, we might come on to talk about it later, but in the PAS 2018, in the updated document, there was a good example that was provided of different options where people had considered the different whole life. And you could see that if you just looked at one aspect, perhaps just the materials you were using, and not at some of the other aspects, perhaps of transport or other things, you would have a false view of where possibly your carbon savings were. So I think having in that stage one or stage two, maybe even early three, really looking at that sort of life cycle, whole life cycle approach is really important as well, because that helps guide you all the way through that project.
In terms of translating that into something that's more meaningful for geotech contractors when we don't get that any engagement or design improvements, I agree with Alice, right? Obviously, we can push back and ask questions and say, why is the design like this? We would always rather upsell a low carbon solution than just continue to install a high carbon solution, obviously. But we were very conscious that actually there's a number of steps we can do even further down in the chain, even when we're actually doing things on site. It's just obviously a far smaller carbon saving than if we're not installing the same solution. So to that point, that's why in some of the European Federation, you know, guide number one, we have the EFFC, we have the carbon reduction piece, and there we focus on basically a carbon hierarchy. It's basically saying do the big things first.
Yeah.
And in that one, I mean, there's a slightly alternative one now in PAS 2080, because it's been obviously relaunched, but we look to eliminate emissions completely. And so that's the piece about alternative ways around certain things, potentially designing out. Go on.
Just come in there, actually, because maybe in some ways that hierarchy seems slightly counterintuitive, because you've got the scope one, two, and three emissions, which the bigger issues are the scope three, aren't they? But you'd think working through it sequentially, in some way, the scope one and two are things probably that are easier to address. But really what you're saying is they're not the big numbers. If we're serious about making a impact on reducing carbon, actually we want to be going for scope three first.
Effectively, yes. So in some carbon reduction case studies that Erica and myself did, we found 70-80% of site emissions, possibly even more on certain heavy foundation projects, are from scope three, particularly from our use of cement and steel, which are very carbon intensive to produce and indeed transport onto and off of site. So yes, scope three is always the prize in all of this. The challenge is, of course, most of those emissions happen in our supply chain, in our supply network, whereas scope one and two, we have more direct control over. So you're right to say that you can certainly get buy-in with some of those early scopes, but scope three is the prize.
I just realised we haven't really defined scope one, two and three. Can you just give our listeners a quick reminder of exactly what they are?
Absolutely. So scope one is our direct emissions from fuel use. So for contractors like Keller, that is mostly from fuel use in rigs, but also for gensets, things like this. We then have scope two, which is indirect emissions from electricity use. So it's mostly things like offices and yards, or where we can hook up to the grid. And then we have scope three, which is all other indirect emissions. And so that covers things like business travel, waste disposal, and material transport. But by far the biggest part of our scope three emissions is our material use. So scope three, by definition, comes in our supply chain. It's somebody else's scope one and two, but it's the big source of emissions for us as contractors.
And that ties up with what I was saying earlier about things you can control and things you can influence. Mm-hmm. So as a geotechnical contractor, you can control your scope one emissions, you can control your scope two emissions, but you can still influence your scope three emissions. Mm-hmm. And for me as a geotechnical designer, my company can think about their scope one and two emissions, which are fairly small because we have some offices, and we can influence our scope three emissions. But we talk about not just our carbon footprint, but in a nice jargony way, talk about our carbon handprint as well, which is the carbon associated with the projects that we're involved in. So we're not directly purchasing the materials that go into building the projects we design, but we are definitely influencing the materials that go in, but also the route alignment, the master planning of that new part of a town, the transport planning, and those massively influencing capital and operational and user carbon emissions. So the emissions from material use, the emissions from running and maintaining stuff, and the emissions associated with people using whatever the thing is that is being designed or built.
Have you seen a shift within Arup? It's an accusation that's been put at all stretch engineers really in the past. I'm not just picking on Arup, that when consultants design or take foundations, because you know that's where we're from, that they tend to be larger elements, shall we say, than when it goes into the sort of D&B world of contractors. Have you started to see sort of slimmer piles, very much in a sort of a carbon reduction focus in mind?
I think yes and no. I think there's always been a push to design things more efficiently, but there's this is leading me on to two of my other kind of things that interest me, which is we talked a bit about how carbon and cost are often quite correlated. And if you reduce the amount of stuff that you are building, you reduce the cost as well as the carbon. But there can be more of a conflict between carbon and program. So I've seen much beefier designs in order to get something off the critical path, for example, or, you know, phased design and construction, where the foundations, which do take a while to go get built and nothing else can start till they're finished, are designed based on some assumptions. And then the rest turns up later on. And the other thing is using carbon to sort of control risk. And I think that designers do get forced to do that to a certain extent. I think if you're a design build foundation contractor, you know exactly what equipment you're going to use. You know how good your team is. You can decide whether you've got enough information about the site, and then you can do a really refined design based on that. Whereas if you're a designer who has not yet got any involvement from a contractor, you have to do a design that would be robust enough to be built by one of several contractors with different, potentially different techniques, different specialisms, different approach to things, designers do sometimes use carbon to control risk. The way projects are set up often requires that. You know, we do all have practice at using at risk management, and I think we should be asking ourselves, all of us in the ground engineering industry, which is, we have to deal with risk a lot in ground engineering because we only ever have a few boreholes and you can never tell where the groundwater is going and all those things. So we have got other skills and techniques, and we should have a bit more of a think about, you know, look out for when you're using carbon to control risk and think if you could do it some other way.
Yeah, I think that was a tricky question. So I think you've answered it really well. Thank you for being candid,
Steve,
about it.
One of the things that Luke was just talking about was the hierarchy. And I think that's a really important thing if people are just trying to think about a sort of simple framework in which they can approach this as well. So I was going to ask Luke.
Please, yes. What I say is, I realize you jumped straight to designs because, of course, that's one of the biggest sources of our carbon is, you know, in our designs and what we put in the ground because of the material use. But across all of this, what I want to say with carbon guides, with the European Federation, with everything else, everybody has a part to play in a geotechnical contractor, whether you're HR and you can influence things like the company car scheme, whether it's procurement and engaging suppliers and this kind of thing, whether it's finance, the more kind of carbon accounting side of this, everybody has a role to play in introducing this carbon hierarchy. So that first stage around eliminating emissions, yes, from a classic design perspective, that is the kind of build nothing type approach. How else can it be fulfilled? And that often isn't so relevant to the contractors, but certainly things like, do you need to travel to that site or can you have a Teams call, for example? These are very practical decisions that happen in an office. After looking to eliminate, you then look to reduce emissions. So this is what Alice was talking about in terms of, for example, improved ground investigation, GI, and how we can reduce the diameter of our piles, reduce the length of piles. These kinds of things, also exploring stuff like efficiency of our processes. So as contractors, often that focuses on efficiency of our equipment, for example, and how much time we spend on site layouts, things like this. After the reduce piece, we then move on to substitute. And that's where some of the kind of exciting papers and things come out. I'm sure we've all seen, you know, Capro's hyperpile system, with hollow piles and all these innovative various things. Low carbon cements, indeed. A number of them have been tried from Semfri, Wagner, ZFC, etc. There seems to be one coming out all the time. But the point is, it's always better to eliminate the cement entirely or reduce the volumes of cement before you start looking at just changing cement types. That's not a silver bullet by itself. Substitute is also where you can look at things like electric vehicles, because of course, in reduced, it's like, do you even need to travel? And then once you've worked through that entire carbon hierarchy, once you've looked to eliminate, reduce, and substitute, only then can you look at those kind of accredited carbon offsetting type schemes in the kind of compensate phase there.
While we're talking about hierarchies, because there's one to fit everything, but yes. I was just thinking how the new PAS 2080 document, so the one that came out this year, 2023, so that's the publicly available specification for carbon management in buildings and infrastructure, which is available for free from the BSI website, and it's got a free guidance document from the ICE website. Their carbon reduction hierarchy now is avoid, switch, improve. So that ties in very neatly with what you were talking about, Luke. So avoid traveling to the meeting, switch your slightly chunkier pile to a more refined pile, and improve what you still have to build by using a lower carbon cement, for example.
Yeah,
so it's a twist on the reduce, reuse, recycle in a way.
It's just a bit easier to apply to anything, and it's been designed to also align with the hierarchy that transport planners use.
Yeah,
because it's just tricky having five different hierarchies which still all say more or less the same thing. So I guess the point I wanted to make was they all say more or less the same thing, and work out what the big stuff is first, but don't forget that there's a lot you can do at the small end too.
Absolutely. And just again, on PAS 2080 carbon management for buildings and infrastructure, I think this time around it is far more contractor focused. It really is worth a while for some of those listeners, because there is something in there for everyone. And that guidance document that Alice briefly mentioned, it really does bring this to life. This is not a dry standard of things you might want to consider doing or tick box because it's a company standard. The guidance document has a number of different case studies of how people have achieved this in real life, how they've applied this hierarchy to various different projects, and what they've been able to achieve as a result. So really worth checking out.
So it's a document to say how you should run your management system to reduce carbon. Is that right? And is something that you would be audited against?
That's right. Yes. So as a client or as a designer or as a constructor or as a supply chain provider, you could become accredited against this. So some major clients will mandate that everyone on their project supply chain is accredited or is working towards accreditation. Having said that, so the actual pass itself is a bit of a dry read because it's the management standard, but the aim is it's not just about quantifying carbon. It's about working together collaboratively across the supply chain, but what your company does within that to achieve ideally systemic whole life carbon reduction. So it's again about all of the carbon that you can influence, even if your contract boundary stops at a particular place. And then the guidance document is a lot less dry. So I've read the whole guidance document and I dip into the PAS.
Okay. But yeah. we do have there's also an ISO, isn't there? Is it 14001? Sorry if I got the wrong number here. For the environment, but it's not specifically for carbon. So what you're saying is the way things will get, clients are going to start asking for a specific certification. So your business, rather than your project, because there's other things out there for projects, which are BREEAM and what's the other one for civil engineering projects?
Now BREEAM infrastructure. It used to be SEQUAL.
It's broader now. That's interesting. This is about your particular business. Erica, I'll come to you.
No, I was going to say that, you know, Luke's point about everyone has a role to play and how easy it is for information to be lost down that value chain. I think PAS 2080 has also, certainly in the guidance, has made it really clear what the roles and responsibilities are of different people within that value chain. And I think that's really important because as you're getting PQQs coming through, as you're getting specifications or submittals, it also helps match that up. So you begin to understand what your role is and how you should be responding to those as well. And I think that's really important.
Okay, how hard would it be for most organisations out there right now to pass PAS 2080?
In my personal opinion, the new revised PAS 2080 has been out for a day short of a month. So it's all very new. There are some organisations that were accredited to the 2016 version, but this is definitely a step up. And I imagine at this stage, any auditor will be looking at intention and maturity and plans in place. I, in my personal opinion, doubt that any organisation is fully there yet. But that's fine. And we should all try and get a lot further along the journey, a lot faster than we had been intending to.
Well, I certainly want to talk about roadmaps in a moment. The EFFC is clearly helping with that journey. At Central Parliament, we've come up with our own roadmap, and it'd be interesting to contrast that with some of the other businesses within the foundation community. Luke, would you like to explain a little bit about the work that you've been doing there within the European Federation of Foundation Contractors?
Sure. So it's probably fair to say we've been on quite a journey over the last few years, certainly compared to when I started my PhD, to think that we'd be quite so evolved as a sector. I definitely wouldn't have thought it. So what we have at the European Federation of Foundation Contractors Sustainability Working Group is a roadmap of basically trying to produce these guides, resources, things to help calculation and start to bring together basically sector-wide best practice across various areas of sustainability. So we obviously spent a lot of time talking about carbon reduction and climate change, and that's very important, of course. But of course, it's also just one area of sustainability. And so just over a month ago now, we launched the EFFC's Circular Economy Guide. So the Circular Economy looks at reducing waste to landfill. It looks at using more secondary materials, recycled materials, extending product lifetime, and then at the end of life, encouraging things like reuse. But actually, all of this is aligned to, as you say, a roadmap of various areas of sustainability that we want to focus on over the next decade, mostly focused around what we know is coming up in EU legislation, but also what is really material to us as geotechnical contractors, where we have the greatest impacts and we need to mitigate that. So that includes things like environmental pollution, water use, areas like this, before we even come on to the more social side of sustainability.
Yeah, it's interesting point there about foundation reuse, which is a topic that's been discussed for a long time. I think the Rufus document came out in 2006, so it's been talked about for a long, long time, and I'm not really seeing a huge amount of reuse of parts. In fact, it's kind of even worse, because what I'm seeing is a number of sites where we're being asked to drill through existing foundations, which seem more carbon intensive, trying to break through those foundations or design around them than indeed trying to reuse them. So one would hope that in the next 20 years or 50 years, I don't know what the life cycle of these buildings are going to be like, that we will still start to see a shift in terms of the quality of the records taken and the sort of future proofing. Alice, I'm sure you've got a view on that.
Yeah, I think it's a shame you're not seeing more foundation reuse yet. I think I am seeing more of it coming through. It's starting to become, I mean, I work in the geotechnics group, who are based in London. So a lot of our commercial buildings projects are in parts of London where there's been many generations of foundations on the site before. So firstly, there is now more demand for lower embodied carbon buildings. And so suddenly not demolish, and also a lot of public resistance to demolishing buildings as well. So suddenly that standard business model of just knocking everything down on the site and starting afresh is going. So we're seeing more building reuse retrofit, and therefore more foundation reuse. But this issue you're talking about of having to drill through existing obstructions is becoming more and more of a problem. You know, sites are at risk of being sterilized if you are looking for a patch of fresh ground to put a foundation in. So I think we will see a lot more foundation reuse from the commercial side of things because of this kind of sterilization, but also because there's a lot more demand now for something that's lower carbon. It makes sense to reuse the foundations. The difficulty is often, again, in the realm of risk, and because you can't ever really tell what was built, how that risk is dealt with. So my urge to everyone who's listening to this is you should take your own thorough, meticulous records of whatever you're designing or constructing or supervising. Or, you know, if you're a client working client side, you should demand a piling closeout report. You should demand that all of the building information is there and you've got all the as-built information and any non-conformances and how they were dealt with, so that in the future your foundations can be reused with confidence. And you should keep it because, well beyond the warranty period. Seeing in our archives from the 70s and 80s, the information we've got from there is really valuable to us now when we are reassessing our own previous designs.
So, Alice, does the Building Safety Act, the new act coming out, change any sort of responsibilities in terms of record keeping? Because, as you say, most people keep their records for 12 years. Occasionally, you will have a big cabinet somewhere and might hang around for a little bit longer. But that's the general wisdom on the topic. But will the new Safety Act mean that we have to hang on to the files for 50 years, perhaps, and then can sort of feed it into the next generation of the site?
I don't actually know, and I've written it down to have a look later.
Okay, well, we'll
yeah. I just feel that it's also something that, you know, perhaps at a more institutional level. So, you know, in London, is there some sort of requirement of London as a government body to actually hold some of this data as well? Because they are more likely to be around for a much greater period of time than perhaps some of the firms that are looking at this. Absolutely. At the moment. Yeah. And they might not be the right body, but is there an institutional holding that might be a better place for it?
maybe it's me being cynical, but also this is a future market for us.
Oh,
so
yes.
Having this kind of data and being able to then offer that to clients in the future when they want to reuse your foundations is actually, it's a real untapped resource around this kind of data sharing. And it's something that is being explored at a trade association level. So the AGS, they have the AGSI standard format of, in terms of recording as built foundations, for example, standardizing how this data is stored and where it is stored in a way that is going to be read by whatever computers or systems that we have in 70, 80 years time when these foundations come up for renewal. There's a big piece about building in foundation reuse right now and opening up that market for the future, even whilst we're still looking at the kind of ground investigation that enables this foundation right now. The other thing I'd say is just very quickly, kind of at the heart of what we keep repeating, yes, it may cost more to do the ground investigation and to assess the piles right at the beginning, but the saving, if you don't have to drill through those foundations, if you can reuse them, is massive. So it's, yes, it's upfront cost for some clients, but there is a real potential for carbon savings, for cost savings in the future.
I know Kieran from the FPS and the FFC is very keen to promote the potential for renting out piles, which it seems a great idea to me if I can be drawing an income for the foundations many years into the future. But I'm not sure how keen the clients will be on that particular idea.
How good is the data for the as-built, which would be something else that I've seen, necessarily in your sector, but in others, the as-built information is often not so good.
Well, ever improving. With foundations, actually, it's relatively easy to record and demonstrate the depth of the piles, the material that's gone in, the exact location that it's gone in. Most of the machinery is computer monitored now. Yeah, it's just a matter of saying, right, this foundation went in at this Eastern and Northing. This was the concrete ticket for the material that was put in it. Here's the care certificate for the steel that went in. It's really straightforward to recall all that. I think a few years ago, we were talking about these huge BIM models, and you kind of imagine this one kind of super file that was going to retain all of the information. So all those construction records that I was just talking about would be saved in this one file. I don't know how many gigabytes this one file is going to be for the whole building, but that was kind of how I was visualizing the future of building record keeping.
Someone suggested to me, and I don't know if it's happening or it's just a cool idea, but how about also having some kind of chip or QR code on the pile cap, somewhere you can access and expose, and that could also have the as-built information there. Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, it needs to be quite robust, but
it would.
Yeah, the concept's a good one. So check out the EFFC website. There's loads of material on that. Alice and Luke, you've all also done a couple of articles that have gone into GE Magazine, which will give you a good summary of some of the work that's going on. Erica, you've also been involved in some publications, I believe.
Yes, I've been doing quite a lot of volunteering work with LETI, that started off as the London Energy Transformation Initiative. That's also been doing a lot of work trying to push people into thinking about best options rather than perhaps government standards. So it's trying to move people to where carbon footprints need to be within different sort of building archetypes. And we've also been trying to do a lot of work on embodied carbon. And I think very much like the work I'm hearing here, it's also been about taking people working within the profession and taking the best knowledge and putting that out, trying to encourage debate, and getting people who perhaps aren't as aware of these kind of issues to start thinking about it. And certainly in the last one that I worked on, we were looking at specifications and procurement, mainly within building design rather than infrastructure. But again, so many of the things that you'll see in past 2080, you'll see within the LETI spec and procurement guide, because you're trying to think about how do you make this work all the way down through the value chain. Quite often it's practically how do you make this work? It's not just theoretically. And some of the things that can be incredibly simple when you look at them on paper can be very difficult to put in into practice. But
you what know, are the big blockers then to the change that you're hoping for?
It's a lot of it's information flow. That's something Luke and I looked at as I was sort of translating it down through the supply chain. Where we've seen things work successfully, one of the projects I looked at was the Natural History Museum are doing a new build. And they made the decision that as scientists, quite interesting, their board is very passionate about this. And they actually employed someone from start to finish across the whole of the project so that they had that continuity working all the way through. They had a carbon champion. So their role was to make sure that things were enacted all the way through. I think also things like carbon budgets I'm seeing coming through a little bit more strongly as well, so that you can set that at the beginning of the program. And that allows for a little bit of flexibility. So if something doesn't work the way you think it might, is there another way we can save and still manage the carbon budget? So I think we're seeing things like that beginning to come through to sort of, in some ways, tie the value chain together. But as Alice said, that sort of thing around collaboration, which is in FAST 2080, sounds so simple, but is so incredibly difficult to do. And in some ways, the worst thing we can have is a contract, because quite often the contracts themselves stop that early engagement with designers and contractors and other specialists. So I think that's another big issue that we're all still trying to work on.
Thanks, Luke. Did you?
I just wanted to pick up on that carbon budget piece, because that's something we've been really exploring across a number of trade associations and indeed conferences now. We have a sector standard carbon calculator, the EFFC DFI carbon calculator. So it basically means we're not competing on emission factors or what we're including or excluding from our carbon calculations. Mm-hmm. We have it certified to various standards, and all we're competing about is the actual design itself. But then the question becomes, when do you measure your project emissions, right? And so some of what we've started to highlight as best practices, yes, highlighting up originally what we get as contractors from the client, from theirs. If we have design control, what we then redesign to, and hopefully that is lower carbon, and then using that carbon calculation as a carbon budget for the project and seeing if we can beat that carbon budget, much like you would do with price. And then at the end of the project, reviewing, did you meet that project? Did you meet that carbon budget? Do we need to reassess how we're calculating carbon? And then using that to feed into future bids. I would just emphasize, of course, measuring is always secondary to actually action. I think sometimes we focus so much on trying to quantify scope 3, and it's a big task engaging, you know, how many of 100,000 suppliers we have globally. But actually, there are very practical steps we can take already to actually reduce these emissions, even if we can't quantify them fully.
Yeah, but on the topic of measuring, I accept your point that it is a secondary thing. Large companies, and I think large is defined as something like more than 250 employees. Apologies if I've got that figure wrong.
You're right.
I think they have to record their emissions anyway. I don't know if that's for the business as a whole or on a project specific basis, and is there a view that this is going to go to all businesses? I suppose this affects some businesses within the foundation sector already. Luke, Caleb must be within that.
We are sufficiently big to fall within SECRA, SECR, Streamlined Energy and Carbon Reporting Directive. So what that means in the UK is that we have to report our scope 1 emissions, those direct emissions from fuel use, scope 2 indirect emissions from electricity use, and scope 3 business travel. What we're starting to see coming up in the EU though, and I should say that SECR covers, as you say, large companies and listed companies in particular. What we're seeing in the EU, though, is something coming out next year called CSRD, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. And I don't want to send everybody to sleep talking about legislation throughout the whole thing. But effectively, what this does is it increases the scope of reporting. So it widens up carbon reporting into broader scope 3, including business travel, waste disposal, material transport. But also, for the first time, it introduces reporting on that circular economy piece. So our raw material use, it introduces reporting on biodiversity, pollution, water use, etc. It is a big step up for Europe. And they've tied a lot of the COVID recovery funds through the something called the EU taxonomy directive to your ability to report on this data and show that you're doing well in terms of improving these metrics. So it is a big push in Europe, and I can see that very quickly spreading into what we have in the UK as well.
Okay. Is there a group within the UK that kind of on the cusp of making that decision, or is that going to be a decision made just at very high government level, whether we just follow it?
It depends in terms of access to finance. So EU taxonomy that I mentioned is probably the first way. It basically sets out what a sustainable investment is, or a sustainable loan, for the first time. So because it's the first one to set this out, we've seen a lot of alignment with it. The other thing with CSRD is, although it's for large companies, there's proportional reporting for smaller companies. So in Europe, they genuinely cannot escape. And if your clients are asking for this data because they need to report, then you need to be collecting it anyway. So particularly for those companies with parent companies in Europe, particularly for those smaller companies that they want access to finance that's green linked, which increasingly it is, this is all of a sudden very important.
Alice has been very patiently waiting with her hand up. Fortunately, it's a virtual hand, and she's not lost the blood from her arm. But Alice, would you like to come in?
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, I think you're right, Luke. This is going to filter down everywhere else. I wanted to follow up on two things that Luke was talking about. So he mentioned carbon measurement and it being secondary to the action. And I just wanted to link that again back to carbon estimation. When decisions are being made, it's really helpful to have a quantified carbon estimate, but it should be accurate enough to give you confidence that the right decision is being made. Yeah, I've seen what I now can't remember who first I heard use this phrase, but I've loved it and kept with it ever since, which is this too soon, whoops, too late, which is, you know, we can't possibly work out whether this is a good, bad thing to do from carbon because we don't have enough information yet. You know, the design of the two alternative options is not complete. And then, well, the design is complete, so we'll move on. We're going to build that one. So just, you know, it's okay to estimate on incomplete information so long as you're confident that the estimate is not so sensitive to your assumptions that you might have had a completely different outcome. That's one. The other thing was talking about carbon budgets. What I would be keen to see happening, and I think that the new pass alludes to this, is that the whatever baseline you set for your carbon reduction target should be based on already assuming that you're going to adopt the good practice that happened last time, not some business as usual from a long time ago. So, you know, if you do something cool and innovative on one project that could be applied on other projects, you should assume that all of the future projects going forwards, if say you're a client and you're commissioning other projects like this, would have that in as business as usual, and then see what can be done on top of that. That's one point. The other is at a project level or a systems level, we should be thinking about the carbon business case for a project the same way we think about the economic business case. Like, what carbon in the world does this project save overall? What capital carbon are we investing? What operational carbon are we applying? And is that the sum of those less than the carbon that's being saved by building this project or retrofitting this building? And I feel that that's going to become increasingly important for projects getting planning permission, for all those kind of things, and also for us all sleeping comfortably at night, I think. And the third one is that at the moment, I think carbon reduction targets and budgets are set based on a sort of an assumption as what might be possible. And depending where you are in the value chain, that's probably fine. But as you get high up in the value chain, you should be thinking about what's net zero compatible. So going back to that carbon business case, if you're going to save this much carbon in the world by, I don't know, transferring some freight off road onto a new section of rail line, then you know what the maximum carbon is you can spend on achieving that, and you shouldn't be going past that. And exactly how that's then divided up between the foundations and the superstructure and so on is that may vary. So, you know, you could put a bridge in some really awful geology if that means that the alignment is really efficient, for example.
I think that's really important, because I still see too many people saying, so do I need to save 5%? You know, it's taking some really quite small percentage at the top end and being quite proud. I mean, it's great, but it's not where it should be. It's not the basis on which it should be.
Let's move on now to talk about some of the emerging technologies. So we mentioned about the big ticket items. I suppose there's none bigger than concrete, and specifically the cement that goes into the concrete for the construction industry. I'm just going to chuck it out there, really. How far off are we from having a genuinely carbon-free cement product? And I'm not talking about as a byproduct of something else, because we've been using GGBS for years, and all right, we're putting a bit more GGBS. So for those that aren't aware, so GGBS is a byproduct of the steel industry. So the carbon that's produced is deemed not to be related to the cement that's going into the concrete, whereas for ordinary Portland cement or CEM1, the carbon is produced specifically as a process from the process to make the cement. I don't think I've explained that very well, but hopefully you can take the point from it. So have we got anything out there at the moment that will not create carbon?
I think we have to start off with the caution of the carbon hierarchy, right? If we skip straight to substitution and straight to this magic bullet of we can do exactly what we were doing before with different cement, we've lost the whole point of this, and we lose a load of the cost, carbon, time savings as well in all of this, okay? That being said, once we've worked through eliminating the use of cement entirely, once we've worked through reducing our volumes of it, there are some opportunities out there. So you're right to mention AACMs, alkali activated cementitious material, which is 95% GGBS from blast furnace slag, 5% magic fairy dust alkali reagent that holds it all together. Right. And that does have some useful properties in some senses, prevent chlorine ingress, slower curing times, can help us in places. And I'm sure the Eurocodes will catch up. They've certainly included this time, for example, the CEM6 stuff with limestone, for example. Okay. I think actually what we're starting to see is, though, because it's seen as this magic bullet, this silver bullet, we're actually shipping in GGBS from abroad now and starting to increase the transport distances and therefore emissions associated with it. And ironically, because the value is being pushed up because of the demand, the share of those initial emissions that you have, given blast furnace, it's actually very high energy, actually starts to increase as well. So there's a few ironies in all of this. Now, fortunately, in the UK and Europe, the cement and steel industries are covered by something called the Emission Trading System, ETS, which basically applies a cap and trade system to carbon, so which decreases every year. So if they emit more than that CO2 than their allocated cap, they can sell carbon credits and basically make money. And if they come in below, then they can sell the carbon credits and make money. And if they come in above, then they have to buy carbon credits. So it's like a carbon tax for these industries. And so actually that has been fueling a lot of innovation here. The other thing that Europe has been doing is something called CBAM, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, which means we can't just import cheap cement and steel from outside the EU and outside the UK that isn't governed by this carbon taxation model. So they have been doing a lot of work on the efficiency of just normal OPC type cements, particularly in terms of the energy used for that process. Unfortunately, producing clinker releases CO2 itself. And I don't want to be the one to go straight to carbon capture and storage and all of this, but there are plenty of other alternatives that they're exploring, additives to the cement as well, to make it far stronger, to again reduce the volumes needed. Whether we get to a fully net zero cement, though, the cement and steel industry are really pushing for 2050. They have their own roadmaps in this. I'm not so sure the innovations are quite there yet.
So presumably, if you had a blast furnace that was powered by electric that would be much better. And as you mentioned there, capturing the carbon, putting it back into the concrete in some way, potentially could make it a stronger concrete and absorb the carbon. Alice, are you aware of any developments on that front?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually multiple alternative concrete mixes under development at different stages of technological maturity. And there's actually an article that's been published in, I think, Concrete Magazine recently by Frag Canavaris, which talks about, you know, claims of lower carbon concrete and you know, what it means. So there's lots of technological development. The ability to apply these confidently on projects varies quite a lot. You know, some of the engineering properties change. The degree of compliance with standards and things changes, which can be more or less of an issue depending on who your client is and what you're regulated by, and also the criticality of the element that you are working with. So I think there's lots of promising alternatives out there. Some will work, some won't. One that I'm quite interested in and that's doing fairly well is calcining clay, because in the UK we do have a lot of clay soil. So there's a bit more of a circular economy feel for that. We have a lot of clay soil that ends up needing to be used somewhere. And calcine, that's basically baked clay, can be used as a cement replacement. But none of these things are totally energy free in production. And so a zero carbon concrete, unless there's some element of sequestration or capture, I think is always going to elude us. Hence, again, needing to think about the production hierarchy to start off with. If you don't build a thing out of concrete, it has zero emissions. Well, yeah. If you don't build it.
I mean, I guess the other thing is that, you know, we are living in an exciting time as well. I mean, the changes that, you know, the policy drivers that Luke was talking about, the ETS, changes in demand, it really has galvanized many sectors of the industry to start looking. And you're absolutely right. Some of those will never fly, that some of them won't work. But it is quite exciting to just see how much is being driven at the moment as well.
That's good. The other part of it is, or one of the other parts is around the plants and the vehicles that we use, which are largely diesel powered, sadly. I saw an article within GE just recently about cementation. I think it's out this week. Cementation had got a sawmet rig on a HS2 site. I think HS2 part funded the project, which was powered by I think it was hydrogen, part hydrogen and part HVO, which is HVO. I wonder how much we'll see in terms of the development of the engine technology. It's been lagging. There are machines out there already. We've spoken about them on the podcast in the past that are electric powered. Sadly, it's very rare that we'll get a power supply to those sites, which is good enough to keep the machine running, work independently. So you don't really want to be trailing wires across the site to power it. And even if you could charge it up overnight, the machine wouldn't be running for very long. So it doesn't really work for large scale plants. Hydrogen seems to be potentially a better option, but I believe there's lots of limitations with that. Luke, are you familiar with the developments on the engine technology?
Yes, although of course contractor we're more a consumer in this space, but it's worth pointing out Keller also has a rig manufacturing division in Germany.
I didn't know that.
So yes,
what are they called?
So KGS they're called. That's because I can't say the full German name because it's very long. But of course they're working through these things, and I've been looking at kind of fleet decarbonization strategies with all of this. I think you're quite right to say these first electric rigs to come out have struggled a little bit, either whether it's in terms of power output, whether it's in terms of getting that electricity supply to site. I guess my challenge would be on that second piece, though, is we need to do this kind of system level change. Maybe we need to be requesting an electricity supply, like we request a good working platform and various other things before we get to site. In terms of hydrogen, I think that does have a much higher power output, and is quite exciting. I think the site that you mentioned on HS2, they've been able to get a green hydrogen supply, so hydrogen generated from splitting water using renewable energy. But it's worth pointing out 97% of the hydrogen in the UK comes from natural gas. Mm-hmm. So actually, in terms of its green credentials right now, it's maybe not as green as 100% renewable electricity, for example. So, and it's also worth saying that this, what we term grey hydrogen, hydrogen from natural gas, is built into the government's hydrogen infrastructure plan as well. So it's not going away anytime soon. It's a great way to store excess renewables if we can do it, but actually it requires a lot of energy to make green hydrogen. More broadly though, the average rig lifespan is probably about 12, 15, possibly for some of the more specialist rigs, 20 years. So the rigs that we're buying now are the ones that we're going to be using come 2050 when the government has its net zero requirements. So for our rigs right now, we have to look at plug-in and play approaches, the likes of HVO. Now that comes with its own difficulties. We could probably have a whole discussion on HVO and certifications and whether that is an actual carbon saving versus, is it from waste sources, is it from palm oil, etc. But that is a kind of stepping stone only to hydrogen equipment, to electric equipment, whatever that might be. But the point is, we have to start looking at it now. This isn't as far away as we think it is.
Yes, it's a scary thought when you mentioned the lifespan of the machinery and how close we are. You know, we've all got these targets, not least the whole country, and I think realistically it is going to be a struggle to attain that. We said about offsetting earlier, and really that's not a route that we want to go down to reach those targets. But we do hear stories of our clients achieving net zero, largely through planting lots of trees. But you know that in itself isn't really a sustainable solution. There's only so far you can go with that, and. Sorry, Alice, you want to come in? I'm starting to ramble there.
No, I think what you're saying makes sense, Steve. I was just thinking as well about how close we are to 2050, and thinking about your perspective, Steve and Luke, working for contractors where your projects are quite immediate. So it's the rigs that you have to think about and what they'll be doing in 2050, but the foundations you're installing now are going in now. But for me, working in design, the projects I'm designing now will be being built potentially around 2050 or not long before then, potentially after, depending. And they will definitely be operational in 2050 and beyond. So for those in geotechnical design, we need to be thinking about this also now, and clients procuring things also, we need to be thinking about it now. But we also need to, I think, keep reminding ourselves that most of our built environment is already built. And if we're thinking about new business opportunities and also the big sustainability picture and decarbonizing the UK, then we should be thinking about what those opportunities are relating to existing infrastructure and existing buildings. It is in some ways easier to build a low carbon new building or a low carbon new piece of infrastructure than it is to decarbonize what we already have. And that's not been traditionally where a lot of our businesses come from. And I think it will be where a lot of our business comes from, whatever part of the value chain we work in. So we should start thinking about that.
Good advice. Well, let's wrap this up by maybe getting an idea from each of you on how to reduce carbon in your life and in your business.
Can I go first? My one is just
go for it, just in case somebody else grabs it.
Yeah, challenge your constraints. But we have been trained professionally to do a really good job of understanding the constraints and delivering within them. And we need to change that mindset and challenge our constraints. That's how we'll get to have a radical change, I think.
Erica, can I put you on the spot?
I think I'll think back to the value chain and the concept of collaboration, because I think for me that is probably the most critical. So it's how do we use all of our skills to bring those different parts of the value chain together? And actually, back to the cost, back to the profit, how do we actually present this to people in a way that they can learn? Experiential learning is really important in this industry to actually be able to do that collaboration to make these things work, because at the moment, it often doesn't.
Luke, final word.
Okay. So in my research, I found the biggest barrier to sustainability generally, including carbon reduction, was before lack of client demand, before a lack of legislation, was that people were too busy. They were too busy with their day-to-day operations, too busy making money to worry about sustainability. So my big lesson would be, this is relevant to every process we carry out. Every process that we do has an impact on sustainability and often carbon. So please read all the guides that we've mentioned in this thing, but make it relevant and make the change to your individual processes, because that's ultimately where change happens. It's not from it doesn't happen as a strategy piece. Yes, that needs to be there. Yes, there needs to be funding there. But ultimately it comes down to what the decisions that we all make in our day-to-day operations, and we all have a part to play.
Excellent. Well, thank you all. It's been a great conversation, and I'm sure our listeners have really enjoyed and benefited from it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If there's a guest or a topic that you'd like to see on the Breaking Ground podcast, please do get in touch. You can find me, Steve Hadley, on LinkedIn. Bye-bye.